Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are live, as we always are. I shouldn't say always, but we usually are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. And that means that if you're listening, the program is still on the wheel, like a piece of clay and ready to be shaped any way that the callers actually shall determine. Because I come to this microphone at 2 o'clock every day and do not have any idea for sure what we'll be talking about. I know that we'll be talking about something related to Christianity and the Bible because that's our general topic. And you can raise the specific topics by calling and asking a question or raising an issue where you have a different viewpoint from the host about some biblical topic or some Christian issue. And we'll be glad to talk to you here in the coming hour. We have one line open right now, and you can call 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And we'll talk first today to Earl, who's calling from San Diego, California. Hi, Earl.
Hi, Steve. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to hear from you.
Yeah, hey, I need a little piece of fatherly advice. I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but I got three children, and they're, how old are they? 3, 5, and 9. And I haven't really been reading the Bible with them like I think I should. And I guess my question is, where, for lack of a better way to put it, where do you start to keep it age appropriate? And, I mean, do you go Old Testament, New Testament? Do you just get any?
Well, some people would just say, just read through the Bible. I was reading about somebody. Who was it? It was somebody in American history who had read through the Bible 5 times by the time he was 8 years old or something like that. And that would include the Old Testament. Now, obviously, if he did that, he must have started when he was about 5 or 6 or something like that. And must have been exposed to everything in there, including all those things in the Old Testament that bothered people.
Right.
And which we might think are not appropriate for children. On the other hand, the law, the Torah, which contains some of the difficult passages, it was said that in Deuteronomy 6 that people should teach the laws to their children when they rise up and when they lie down and when they walk in the way and so forth. So apparently God felt that the material in the Bible is not inappropriate for little children. I think that the things that would be most, maybe the most shocking, would be more shocking to more mature minds. The little children, when you read the Old Testament stories, them are going to have a lot of questions. You know, why did they do this and why did they do that? But they're not going to have so much, I don't think they're going to have, I don't think they're going to take offense to things or be shocked by things that are, let's say, sexually explicit or whatever. You know, I mean, Judah sleeping with, his daughter-in-law thinking she was a prostitute, or David having an affair with Bathsheba. It's going to go right over the head of small children. They won't know what that's about, and it won't be a problem to them. The violent stuff, you know, I don't know. I don't. It shouldn't. I mean, it might bother some children, but it's reality, and it was something that God didn't see any problem with having the Jews expose their children to. But you'd have to use your own discretion there. Some people would find stories in the Old Testament just too difficult to explain to their children.
I think maybe that's my hesitation, because you always like to have an answer for them, and sometimes I just don't, you know.
You know, when I was growing up, my father was the guy I came to with questions about the Bible. I read the Bible as a child and as a youth, and I came to my dad and asked him questions, and he was no expert. You know, he was a Bible reader. He had a lot of excellent theological books in his shelves, which many of which he had read, but he didn't remember much. I mean, his vocation was in an entirely different field than what mine is now. I mean, he was not in the ministry, but he would read with interest. But when I would ask him a question, a lot of times he didn't know the answer. A lot of times he'd just tell me where I might find it in a book, or he'd just say he didn't know. I remember very, and I've told this story before, that I'm driving down the street on the way to church one Sunday, we passed an Assembly of God church on the way to our Baptist church, and I asked my dad, what do these people believe different than we do? And he said, I think they believe a lot of things the same as we do. He says, the main difference would be that they speak with tongues. And I said, what does that mean? He said, I don't know. And that was enough. I mean, he didn't know. I figured I don't need to know. At least I didn't need to know at that time. Later, it interested me more. But, I mean, sometimes we're afraid to say I don't know to our kids, and it doesn't really offend them as much as we think it might. I remember asking my dad when I was little what heaven is like. And he said, well, it's a place where you'll have everything you want. You know, well, that's a true statement, not a very sophisticated one. And I definitely got the wrong impression of what that meant. But on the other hand, as I matured, I realized that the answer was a correct answer. And it just meant something different than what I thought it meant. So, I mean, I don't think you should be afraid to tell your children either that you don't know the answer to a question, or that or to give them a very simple answer that seems to be true and, you know, adjusted to their level of intelligence. But, you know, if you're reading, in Genesis 6 and it says, you know, God, you know, repented that he made man on the earth and it grieved him in his heart. And so he sent the flood. If your child says, well, why did God make man if it was going to grieve him like that? I mean, if you don't know the answer, just say, I don't know. And you see, what that tells them is that you don't claim to be the final authority on matters, and what it really tells them is that you're resigned to the fact that there are things you don't know, but that doesn't keep you from, necessarily believing them, or that doesn't keep you from reading the Bible. What it's basically saying to your child in an underlying message is, I believe in the Word of God, and I trust God to know the answers, and some of them I don't know myself, but I don't need to. I don't need to know all the answers. It's good enough that God knows the answers. And that's at least the message I got. When my dad said he didn't know something, I just felt like, well, apparently it's okay not to know some stuff. But his not knowing it did not in any way damage his faith in the Word of God. And therefore it's implied that God, the fact that God knows is enough, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, you will know much more than your children know, so you'll be able to answer questions a lot. But, I mean, you shouldn't ever be afraid that you have to say, I don't know. Now, I would possibly want to start them off in the New Testament with the stories of Jesus. Now, I never got children's Bibles for my kids.
That was my next question.
Yeah, I mean, some people do. Some people get children's Bibles for them or children's Bible story books, and some kids may like that. Although I don't know, I haven't raised kids for a while because my kids are all grown now. But my kids didn't have all the videos and TV and stuff like that and video games to raise the threshold of their attention span or their stimulation addiction. You know, so I mean, you could show them a picture book and they'd be interested in the pictures. I don't know if the modern child will be satisfied with the picture book because it's not moving and it's not talking back to them and stuff. I mean, it's just not like TV and video games. I'm not sure if picture books still grab the attention of children, but I suppose it could if they're not oversaturated with the media and overstimulated.
Yeah, they still run to me with books, read this to me, you know, with pictures and everything. So that's still popular.
Well, the reason we didn't give our children children's Bibles is because we wanted to raise their biblical literacy to a high level early on.
Did you use King James?
We used the New King James.
New King James. Okay.
So now my children were homeschooled and they all learned to read when they're about 4 or 5. So as soon as they learned to read, we bought them their own New King James Bible because that's what my wife and I were using, and so we could all read our Bibles together. And I'd have the children read out loud. Of course, you have to be patient when they're just learning to read and help them along. But the point is that they could feel that they're reading the same Bible that their parents are reading.
Right.
And also, because it's adult language, it helped them, you know, whatever you are immersed in, that is, whatever culture, whatever level of erudition, whatever educational standards are placed upon you in your environment, you'll rise to that, unless you rebel against it. But little kids aren't likely to rebel against it. They want to learn. So, I mean, by having my kids when they were 4 and 5 reading the New King James, my children became very, not only biblically literate, they were reading a real translation and not a dumbed-down version, and it caused their biblical literacy to rise. I remember sitting with my older son in a restaurant in Santa Cruz when he was 5 years old, and we were waiting for our food to come, and he took his butter knife and mine and started rubbing the blades against each other, and he said, "As iron sharpens iron, so does the countenance of a man his friend," or something like that. And
wow.
You know, quoting from a proverb, and I was stunned because I didn't know he was familiar with that proverb, and secondly, I didn't know that at 5 years old he would, upon reading that proverb, get the concept of, you know, two iron objects sharpening each other, you know, the kids are sharp, and they will be sharper still.
Yeah,
if you expect them to be sharp and you elevate their literacy rather than dumb down everything to them, I think they will rise to it and they'll be pleased to.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, like I was saying, I think I tend to underestimate them sometimes because every once in a while, you know, they'll blow you away with how much they really do soak in and retain.
Yeah, yeah. My kids not only became very biblically literate, they also became very articulate and had good vocabularies. And I think that's because we had them reading the real Bible, not a children's version, when they were little. Not real little, but when they were old enough to read.
Right. Makes sense. Well, I know you have other callers, and I appreciate it more than I can say.
Well, Earl, I appreciate your call and your desire to read the Bible to your children. I really hope that you will set a habit of that and keep it up. It'll make a huge difference to them in their later years.
I appreciate it.
All right. God bless you, brother.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. Okay, let's talk to Lowell, calling from Colorado Springs, Colorado. We have a line open for you also. If you have a question about the Bible or about your Christian life or about anything like that, or you want to disagree with the host, feel free to call. Bring correction, bring balance to the program. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Lowell, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Yeah.
Hi.
I'm Colorado Springs, and I've talked to you several times over the
years. I know. I am welcome.
Yeah. And just to comment about something you said in early part of 2005 and how that's changed now. And the comment was, I was going to first start listening to you in early 2005.
Uh-huh.
You said that pertaining to dispensationalism, which you really helped me with at that time, you said that study Bibles had a lot of dispensational notes.
Yeah.
Well, recently, in the last month, that's really changed. For instance, I thought I would announce that or comment on that.
Okay.
Two study Bibles have come out, September and October. In September, it's the New Living Translation, which is a team of scholars. It's way beyond Kenneth Taylor started, and they have a study Bible. There is no dispensational language in the entire thing.
And excellent. About time.
Neither is it Reformed. So, but it has what we would consider the Reformed continuity between, I think what you would teach in terms of the eschatology would
uh-huh.
be similar. But in terms of the doctrines of salvation, when it has an opportunity to have a, you know, Calvinist verse, it doesn't really comment. It goes with general theology. But the language, rather than using the Church Israel language, it uses the term God's people.
Mm-hmm.
The temple in the Old Testament, they explain, especially at Ezekiel 40, they have three articles about the temple building pointing to Christ, and that's the only option they give. They do not give a dispensational option.
They don't talk about a millennial temple then.
They don't even mention it as a possibility.
Interesting.
Yet the building points to Christ. The architecture points to Christ in the new creation. The land, they have three articles on it. They have 300 theme articles scattered throughout the Bible, all concisely written, all to the language of a to the vocabulary of a new Christian. but written by an excellent team of scholars. There's no concept of the last days tribulation. The last days is only the inter-Advent period. They don't go for this eschatological tribulation concept. They don't have, in 2 Thessalonians 2, they don't have a strong Antichrist figure. Daniel 9, they mention the gap theory in about three sentences, but they don't talk about it in reference to, Israel or a future seven-year tribulation. They just mention it as a Daniel 9 theory. They have two messianic theories for Daniel 9.
Wow.
One, the AD 70 theory, similar to what you teach. The other is a more broad New Covenant where it goes clear to the end of the age. So they just present those two. They also present the Maccabean interpretation without really criticizing it.
That's interesting.
So they're open to it. The word millennium appears one time in Matthew 24, where in verse 40, where it speaks of one taken and one left.
Uh-huh.
They said they used the word there, and in Revelation 20, they're able to explain the premillennial. They just give like a three sentence explanation of each. They are non-biased.
Uh-huh.
They just explain the general themes.
That's great.
Revelation 20. I think it's a great study Bible and good scholarship. I think it's quite a breakthrough from the comment as recently as 2005. I think it was true that when you go to the bookstore, especially the family bookstore, you would find a lot of that in there.
But it used to be that all study Bibles were dispensational, whether it's Schofield or Ryrie or you name it, Dakes. But then they came out with the Reformed Study Bible or something like that, which had the Calvinistic Reformed theology in it, and that was several years ago. But still, I don't know that I've ever seen that sitting on a bookshelf in a bookstore. They might have them, but still, when you go to a bookstore, you normally see the dispensational stuff. Now, it's interesting. The one you're talking about is called the New Living Translation Study Bible or something like that?
Which would have originated in the 60s with Ken Taylor.
Well,
now
the Living
team of scholars.
Yeah, well, I know that.
Very scholarly now.
Yeah, the Living Bible in the late 60s was put out by Ken Taylor, but for several years now they've had the New Living Translation, which was somewhat more scholarly update or maybe replacement
right.
for that. But they haven't always had the notes you've described, I don't think, in it.
The notes have only been out for 5 or 6 weeks.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, it came out, so that is quite impressive.
Yeah, well, I'll have to get a hold of it.
Done. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Notes.
I don't know that I'll prefer the New Living Translation as a translation, but if the notes are good, I should get a copy and take a look at it.
I put the notes on my pocket. Liridian has it.
Oh, uh-huh.
Liridian, you can download it. So I link it to my ESV or whatever translation I
sure.
want.
So
I
years ago. Years
yeah,
ago, I got myself a NIV Study Bible, even though I don't like the NIV as a translation. The NIV Study Bible notes appeared to me to be very even-handed, though I think they were leaned a little bit toward dispensationalism. They didn't seem to be quite as doctrinaire and such
yeah.
as most of them. But and I used to tell people that if you want a good Study Bible, maybe the NIV Study Bible has some of the better notes that I've seen in a study Bible, but I don't care for the NIV translation. And that might end up being the case with this one.
Yeah, and then the ESV Study Bible came out last week. J.I. Packer was the general editor. It doesn't use the Reformed language like elect. It uses the words God's people.
Uh-huh.
On certain favorite Calvinist verses, like in Peter on predestination, It will say, Calvinists say this, and Wesleyans say this.
Well, that's good.
But it doesn't criticize.
Yeah. I think it's better for them to give the different views than to not even mention that there are different views. Yeah, I think that's
yeah.
good.
And it mentions dispensationalism a lot. It'll say many times, dispensationalists believe this. And it's
uh-huh.
put out a very fair view. But but it never follows it. It just say it helps you, and like in the book of Revelation, many times it says the dispensational view says 144,000 means Jews evangelizing during 7 years of tribulation, and it just kind of leaves it, and then it just moves. It moves on with its interpretation and basic flow, which leans Reformed. I would say that it leans Reformed in most places, but it doesn't have the Reformed exclusive language. Like it doesn't have any articles about infant baptism, or it doesn't strongly prefer it. It leans towards the Reformed, but with some really a lot more scholarly notes.
Yeah. Well, that's what I would expect from J.I. Packer, although he is strongly Reformed. I certainly would expect him to be not dispensational. But the thing is, I'm surprised that he's quite as even-handed as he is there, because I don't think that J.I. Packer is a person who's normally extremely tolerant of other views than his own. I know that when I wrote the Revelation 4 views, there's a number of scholars I sent, the first 100 pages to for them to read and to see if they'd write something about it. And, Packer was one of them. And he said that he wouldn't, recommend it because he felt like three of the four views were, what was the word he used? A very strong word, corrupt I forget the word he used, but he felt like three of the four views that were in my book, he said, he thought were evil. I mean, the word was something equivalent to evil. And he didn't say which of the three, because I'm not sure which one he holds. I would imagine he probably holds the idealist view, because a lot of Anglican scholars do. But anyway, so I didn't... what was the word he used? I can't remember now what he said. But it was something where he made it very clear that he thought they were abominable, and didn't think they should be represented side by side. So I guess he's maybe softened or something.
I think he was the general editor, but they used a large team.
Yeah.
People from Reformed seminaries, but there's other seminaries represented. Revelation was done by Dennis E. Johnson, and his commentary on Revelation is called Triumph of the Lamb.
Okay.
And I have read that commentary, and his commentary language would be Reformed. He would defend the Amill view, but as he wrote Revelation notes for the ESV Study Bible, he was much more even-handed, and he mentioned the dispensationalist view a lot, but he didn't really criticize it. But he did bring it up. I think it's helpful as you read through it. Compare his view, which is a progressive parallelism or recapitulation, but also see what dispensationalists would say at that point.
Yeah. Now, it's called the ESV Study Bible. Is it recently out, or has it been out for a while?
It came out October the 15th.
Okay, so that one and the other one both came out just in the past month or less.
Right, that's why I thought I would call and announce that things have changed. They're in family bookstores. You mentioned the Reformation Study Bible. The Zondervan stores in my neighborhood would not carry that. They only would carry dispensational and NIV Study Bible type things.
Yeah.
So the non-dispensational view that's clear was not represented, but it is now. They are carrying the Reformation Study Bible in most of the family bookstores now. The salesman said that he likes the Reformation Study Bible. He thinks it's good. That's the one Sproul did, and most of them carry it.
Okay.
Plus, they are actually have lots of copies of the New Living Translation Study Bible. It's out there prominently, and the ESV Study Bible. So,
that's good.
Now the way the shelf looks, you still got NIV, you still have a little Schofield and John MacArthur, but it's a lot more balanced.
Uh-huh. That's good. Sounds very good.
Okay.
Hey, I appreciate that update on that, Lowell.
Yeah, just one more thing. I took my son to Wheaton College.
Uh-huh.
I talked to the Bible professor, Yeah, they have 30 on their faculty that teach the Bible and theology.
Uh-huh.
I said, how many dispensationalists do you have left? And you can probably guess the answer. Zero.
Really? Because they used to have a lot.
They don't have any.
That's interesting.
So,
well, I think dispensationalism is perhaps dying among scholars.
It's Wheaton, he said, he thought one was maybe leaning progressive. They got one.
Yeah.
Which is pretty far removed from the, right. He said he's pretty far away from Ryrie.
When I was talking to Tommy Ice last weekend, he said that at Dallas Theological Seminary, there's not that many dispensationalists left. You know, they have the progressive dispensationalism there, but there's not very many classic dispensationalists. In fact, Tommy Ice felt that Dallas Theological Seminary has become liberal because of that, because they're not classic dispensational anymore as much.
So I think we've seen that move in the seminaries, the colleges, Wheaton's an example, and now study Bibles. So that's going to mean the public it's going to go fast.
It's
going to go fast now.
And I hope that these colleges are not getting rid of dispensationalists because the colleges are going liberal. You know, in other words, you could remain conservative and get rid of the dispensational influence. That'd be, to my mind, a positive move. But I think that if an institution was going liberal, they'd tend to get rid of the dispensationalists too, and that wouldn't be necessarily an improvement.
We went to Wheaton held a 2-hour seminar on how they teach the Bible courses at Wheaton. The place, the Wheaton Billy Graham Center was packed. It had over 300 parents there. It's a high degree of interest on how they teach the Bible. And I was very, very impressed.
Excellent. Well, Lowell, I appreciate that update.
Yeah. Okay.
That's very good reviews on those two study Bibles. I'll look them up.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Dave. That's good.
God bless you, man.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye now. Okay, let's talk to Rashad calling from Elmont, New York next. Hello, Rashad. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. My question today is this. As far as the whole, abortion issue, this is where I'm going with this. A girl can be 5 months pregnant, walk into a doctor's office, and get an abortion, and that doctor didn't do anything wrong. But if that same girl is crossing the street, same 5 months pregnant, and that doctor drunk drives and kills her, and the baby dies, he can get charged with a double homicide. What do you think of that whole issue, where in one situation the baby isn't a person, but in the second situation, all of a sudden it's the baby's a person?
Yeah, I've seen that inconsistency in law before. I mean, not just that one case you gave, but I think in any case where a person does violence to a pregnant woman and the baby dies in the womb, I believe that manslaughter charges can be brought. And it's ironic because, like you say, a doctor who kills that baby deliberately will get away scot-free, won't even be charged with a crime, but someone who accidentally kills the baby will be charged with manslaughter. And, of course, the only difference is that the woman approves in one case and not the other. So, in other words, the woman, there is an admission in the one case that the baby is a human being and has a right to life that is violated when a criminal does something to bring that baby's life to an end. That child's right to life has been violated, and therefore it's called homicide. And yet the mother has the power to deny that baby the right to life in a circumstance that no parallels nothing else in law. We don't have any other situation where one human being can deny another human being the right to life. And, of course, the reason is they always say it's the woman's body, it's the woman's, reproductive choice and so forth. But that, to my mind, is so absurd, because either the child is a human or it's not a human. If it is a human, then it's not the woman's body. It's true, the child is in the woman's body, but we're not talking about damage to the woman's body. We're talking about damage to another human being whose human rights are upheld in other laws. So, I mean, we just have a culture that has lost interest in consistency and lost interest in anything like logic in deciding certain social issues that are political hot buttons, and that are, you know, that strike close to home of people's sexual lives, really. I mean, the abortion on demand was brought in through feminism, really. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, that's not a propaganda statement of mine. It can be demonstrated that abortion on demand, easy abortion, was one of the planks of the feminist movement. And the early feminists indicated that they had to get women to the point where they could be as promiscuous sexually as men without suffering consequences, and that was going to require that they get easy abortion. Well, feminism has conquered our society, and along with it, easy abortion. So what it was all about, it's not about a mother's health. I mean, anyone who says that abortion is about a mother's health is, they're like an ostrich. They've got their head in the sand. They're not thinking straight. Most women's health are not endangered by pregnancy. Certainly the vast majority of women who get abortions have no health issues involved. It's just a matter of women wanting to have sex and not have consequences for their sex.
I lost my train of thought. It will come back to me.
Oh, well, I mean, my point was pretty much made. You know, people say that women should have reproductive choice, and I believe they do. They have the choice to have sex or not have sex. A woman who has not been raped, at least, and gets herself pregnant, got pregnant voluntarily. She made a choice. But once she has a child inside her, it's no longer a choice of whether she'll reproduce or not. She's already done that. She's already reproduced. Now the question is she going to uphold the rights of another human being that she reproduced? It's the issue of abortion is not a matter of reproductive choice. And even those people who want to give the woman the right to abort in the case of rape, that's still not a matter of reproductive choice. The woman didn't have a choice. Of course, when someone raped her, someone took that choice from her and she reproduced against her will. But now that she has a baby, we still have the issue of whether this baby has any human rights or not. And anyone who says it does not has got a lot of explaining to do, and especially explaining why certain laws are written still to uphold the human rights of the child in a case where the woman doesn't want it aborted.
Yeah. And this is what I was going to say, kind of like a connected issue. You know, you have those same people who would, you know, if you kick a dog, they think you're doing some kind of grave sin. But yet it's okay to kill a baby inside of a womb. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, well, I agree that we shouldn't kick dogs, I don't think we should have any cruelty to animals. But you're right; it's a total inconsistency to say it's okay to dismember a living child in the womb or burn it to death with saline solution or something. When everybody knows now, at least everyone who's paid any attention to the research, that baby feels that pain. Just like if it was outside the woman, you cut its arms and legs off and took its brain out of its head. I mean, the baby feels that as much in the womb as it would feel it outside the womb. So, people who are for abortion but against cruelty to animals are simply, once again, not having any interest in consistency in their ethics. They just have a political agenda. And, you know, the political agenda, like so many other issues in modern politics, is to uphold the sexual revolution so that people can do whatever they want sexually and free themselves from the traditional responsibilities that usually come with sexual activity.
Okay. Last question relating to this. What do you think about the whole quote-unquote health of the mother issue? Because I believe that could be so broad.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they definitely need to define what do they mean by the health of the mother. Because all the other things say is like, I think I'm going to feel depressed. You know,
right, exactly. Okay. I mean, there are times when giving birth to a baby or keeping a baby full term might endanger the woman's life. As, for example, in a tubal pregnancy. You know, in a tubal pregnancy, it would appear to me that baby either has to be removed or both the baby and the mother are going to die. That would be, a rather unusual situation, but it's not unheard of at all. there may be a few other cases, and I'd say relatively few, where the baby has come to, you know, close to full term and somehow is endangering the mother's life. And I don't, you know, I'm not sure what to say in a case like that. I think there's a sense in which one could argue that the baby's life could be taken, you know, in order to save the mother's life. Though, I'm not really sure. I would think anyone who had real motherly instincts would rather give her life and save the baby if possible. But if it's either she's going to die with the baby in her and the baby die too, or the baby's going to be taken and the woman's going to survive. In other words, if it's a matter of saving one of the two lives or losing them both, then I'm not sure, but I would certainly be open to the idea in those extremely rare cases, perhaps, of making that hard decision. On the other hand, I don't see, as some do, a case for abortion in the case of rape and incest. Now,
yes.
People say, well, but that's so traumatic. It'd be too traumatic for the girl to carry the baby to term. It could well be. There's no question. I think the trauma primarily was the rape itself and the incest. And, of course, it continues to be traumatic as she bears a baby that she, you know, that she knows was a product of that. Although once the baby has come, she can give it up for adoption. She can go to counseling and try to get over the trauma. The fact that she was raped means she's going to have trauma to deal with no matter what. The question is she now going to add injustice and murder to her list of problems? I mean, once she kills that baby, she's got other trauma to deal with, and that's her conscience for having killed a child that didn't do anything wrong. You know, the child's father might have done something wrong, but the child didn't do anything wrong, so why murder it? It's still a child.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds, when I say I don't believe in abortion in cases of rape and incest any more than in other normal cases, people think you're not very sensitive.
Yeah.
But the person who is for the abortion is not sensitive. They're willing to painfully kill an innocent child. Because, not because the child did anything, but because it had a bad dad who did something wrong. And, as I said, if there is a trauma, and there certainly is a trauma for the girl who's been raped and has to carry a baby to term, you're not solving the trauma problem by aborting the baby. You abort the baby, she still has the trauma of the rape. She's not going to forget the rape. That was the ultimate violent crime. But if she follows up by committing a violent crime herself against an innocent baby, then she has got more to deal with than just the trauma of the rape. She's got that and murder on her conscience. That does not improve the situation. Two wrongs don't make a right.
Exactly. She's most likely going to increase her trauma by, you know, by aborting.
Yeah, I do believe so. And that has been shown to be the case. I mean, some women apparently feel no trauma after an abortion, or at least they don't say that they feel any. I mean, not everyone talks about it, I'm sure. But if a woman did not feel any trauma after having an abortion, it's because she has been misinformed that what she removed was merely a tissue blob. But once she gets older and does more research or learns more, as anyone eventually will if they pay any attention to the evidence that's out there, she will eventually know that what she killed was a human being. And if she didn't know it at the time, that's got to weigh on her conscience, unless she has no conscience left. And some women perhaps don't. Some women and men don't have any conscience left. But anyone who's not become a total hard-hearted sociopath is going to feel awfully bad when they realize that they killed an innocent baby.
Yeah. I don't know if you knew this, but sometimes... You know, sometimes the baby is born alive, and then the doctor kills the baby outside the womb.
I've heard that. And of course, there's a long time ago, back in the 70s or the 80s, there was the case of Baby Doe. You know, Down syndrome child that was born. It was born healthy, except it had Down syndrome, and the parents didn't want the baby, so they didn't kill it. They just let it die of starvation.
Wow.
And it was a notable case because when news of it got out, there were many, many people contacted the couple saying, we will adopt the baby, feed the baby, let us have the baby, we will adopt the baby. And they wouldn't let it be adopted. They wanted it to die. And the media referred to the parents as courageous because they took this stand. I'm not sure how it becomes courageous to kill a baby. That sounds very cowardly to me, and very evil too.
That's pretty terrible. Wow.
That's where our society has come to. And you know, if the voice of the Christians is ever silenced in this country, which I think there's some strong forces trying to do that, our society will slip that way much faster than it is now. It'll become like Nazi Germany. Inconvenient people will be removed.
Yeah. Well, all right, Steve. That's one I wanted to talk about today.
Okay, Rashad. Thanks for your call.
Okay, no problem. God bless.
You too. Bye now. All right, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and we have a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. I'm sure there's people within the range of this radio signal who don't agree with what I said about this or some other subject, certainly about this last point. And if you would like to call to disagree, you're welcome to do that. Or if you have a question about the Bible or Christianity, you can call for that reason too. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Next caller is Derek from McMinnville. Hi, Derek. Good to hear from you again.
Yeah. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
All right.
Good. I had a question regarding a psalm. I forget which psalm it is exactly, but there's a place that says, you have magnified your word above your name. I've always wondered what that means.
I have wondered what it means, too. It's not an obvious answer to that. And there are commentaries I've read on it that are not really sure. I think what some think it means is that his word that he magnifies is his promises and his threats. And there's a sense in which he has kept his word even at the expense of his reputation, at the end of his good name, as it were. Remember when Isaiah said, he says, my name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you?
Yeah.
What he's referring to there is that God, in keeping his threats that he had earlier made, sent Israel into captivity because of their idolatry, sent Judah into captivity because of their idolatry. He said he would do it through the prophets, and he did. He fulfilled it. And in doing so, of course, he took the risk that the pagans would misunderstand what was going on, because in that day and age, every nation had their own tribal gods. And whenever one nation would defeat another in war, the assumption was that the gods of the victorious nation were superior to the gods of the conquered nation and had proven it by conquering those people. And so by God allowing Israel to be conquered by Babylon and taken away in captivity, he gave the pagans the impression that the gods of Babylon are more powerful than the God of Israel. And therefore, God took a hit on his own reputation in the eyes of the Gentiles, his own name, by fulfilling his word of warning and threat that he gave them, that if they did not repent of their idolatry, he'd take them into captivity. So he fulfilled his word even at the expense of his good name, of his reputation. And that it might be that it means that. I've never really been quite sure.
It's almost like swearing to one's own hurt and not changing.
Yeah, like it hurt God. It hurt God to fulfill this threat, but he did it anyway because he keeps his word.
Yeah. All right. Well, that actually makes sense. I mean,
it makes sense, but I have to tell you the truth. I'm not sure if that's what it means.
Huh.
I mean, it might. I don't know if that passage means that, is what I'm saying. I mean, it could. It would be a sensible thing for it to mean, in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay.
That, by the way, is Psalm 138, verse 2.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate that.
All right. God bless you.
Thank you.
Good talking to you.
Thanks. Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Bye now. All right. Now, our lines have just cleared, and we have about, 8 minutes left. That's enough for at least one call, maybe two. If you'd like to be on the program, give me a call right now. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. 90. And if you have a question or a matter of difference of opinion, this is the time to get it in. You could even possibly have the last word today on the program. In fact, the last word, not just today, but this week. This is Friday. The week is over, and we won't be coming back on the air again, of course, till Monday. So this is your last opportunity, this week at least, to get on board here and have your say or ask your question. I have questions that people have written in. One of them was from Jeffrey in Portland. And he said, are we in the last days? And in answer to that, I have to say, I guess the question would be the last days of what? Now, I don't mean to be flip. I realize that when people say, are we in the last days, they usually mean the last days of the world, you know, as the near the end of the world. But when the Bible uses the last days, I'm not really sure that the Bible uses the term that way. It may. But in many places, when the Bible talks about the last days, it's not talking about the end of the world. I mean, almost all the New Testament writers indicated that they were living in the last days 2,000 years ago. In Hebrews chapter 1, the opening verses say that in these last days, God has spoken to us through His Son. John said in 1 John, little children, it is the last hour. And we know that Antichrist should come, and not many Antichrists have come. Thereby we know it's the last hour. Peter, on the day of Pentecost, said, this is that which the prophet Joel spoke of, where he said, in the last days I'll pour out my spirit on all flesh. So, in other words, the last days of what? I believe, in many cases, the last days of the Jewish order are referred to. And that ended in A.D. 70. So we're not in those last days. Now, are we living in the last days of the world? I don't really know. I don't know of any way for us to know that. It kind of seems like we might be, but then in many generations previously, people thought they were living in the end times. It seemed to them that that was true. And we really just don't know, because there's nothing that the Bible tells us that would give us, a sure read on how near the end of the world is. So I'm not really prepared to answer that question. Just because the information is not really available to us, in my opinion. Kara Lee from Salinas is our next caller. And Kara Lee, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I wanted to thank you for all your comments about the abortion issue. I think you're brave to take that on, and that's very commendable. I really appreciate that.
I'm not brave. I just say what I think, and I'm not aware of any danger to me. Of course, my house may be bombed tomorrow, but I'm not aware of any danger.
right. But anyhow, I know it's very controversial, but in 1970, I had a daughter with Down syndrome. And at the time, the doctors were very negative about it. They said, just forget you ever had her. She'll lay in the bottom of a playpen. She'll never do anything. She'll just be a blob. Just forget you ever had her and put her in an institution somewhere.
How encouraging those people are.
Yeah, aren't they? A lot of heart. Of course, I didn't listen to him. But so then he said, well, she'll probably die within 3 months anyhow. So I didn't get very much sleep the first 3 months. I rocked her in a little cradle next to my bed that squeaked, and every time it stopped rocking, the squeak stopped, and I'd wake up and check her breath, and then finally after 3 months I said, Lord, I give her to you. Wake me up if she needs my help, or take her if you should take
her. We're almost out of time. Tell me what happened to her. How's she doing?
No, she's great. She was born in 1970, so she's 38 years old. She lives with her oldest sister, and she's a real character, and our whole family would have missed out on an awful lot if she hadn't have stayed in our lives. But
every Down syndrome person I have met has been just delightful to be with. I mean, I've known adult Down syndrome people, and they're very sweet and very lovable, and it would be a shame that somebody had decided to kill them for no better reason than that they weren't absolutely average.
Exactly. I think sometimes those people tend to show someone their own heart, and I think that's what they're afraid of.
That could be.
Something so pure.
Yeah. Kelly, I've got another call to take before
sure.
I'm done here.
Sure.
I've got to run.
All right.
Thank you for that testimony, sister.
All right. God bless.
All right. You too. Bye now. Okay, Frida from Woodburn, Oregon, you truly get the last word here today. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
The Bible says the Lord has not given us a spirit of fear, but the power of...
love, power, and a sound mind.
Yeah. What do you think, how do you get that? I mean...
How do you get that?
And this... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I believe there's two parts to the answer to that. One is, of course, we need to be filled with the Spirit initially.
Yeah, that's true.
And then secondly, we need to walk in the Spirit. Now, the second is more complex than the first. If you are a born-again believer, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ,
yeah,
with all your heart, then you have every right to ask God to fill you with the Holy Spirit.
Well,
and to expect Him to fulfill that promise. And once that has happened, that doesn't mean that you are forever filled with the Spirit just because you asked that one time. But God wants us to walk in the Spirit. And Paul in Galatians chapter 5 said, if we walk in the Spirit, we'll not fulfill the lust of the flesh. And fearfulness is, I believe, one of those things that will be conquered by walking in the Spirit. Paul gives a long list of things that he calls the works of the flesh, mm-hmm, which will dominate our lives if we aren't walking in the Spirit. Then he lists the things that are the fruit of the Spirit, which will dominate our lives if we do walk in the Spirit. And
mm-hmm,
and the first on that list is love. Now, we know that 1 John says that perfect love casts out fear.
That's true.
And so if we are walking in the Spirit and we are loving, that means we'll be loving selflessly. It means that we're not thinking about ourselves. We're thinking about others. The less we think about ourselves, the less we will have anything to be afraid of. Because even though we may be in danger, we won't be thinking about that. we'll be thinking about our duties rather than our privileges. We'll be thinking more about how we can pour ourselves out and maybe even risk our lives to help others, rather than to protect ourselves and be afraid of dangers to us. I think walking in the Spirit, and especially having the fruit of the Spirit, love and peace, gentleness, and being, you know, love. And Paul said we have been given a spirit of love and power and a sound mind. Now, Jesus said Jesus said in Acts 1:8, you'll receive power.
Right.
When the Holy Spirit comes upon you.
That's true.
And so that's one of the things that the Spirit brings. And then, of course, the sound mind. I don't know that there's mentioned much elsewhere of that, except that we are changed from glory to glory by the Spirit of God, Paul said, 2 Corinthians 3:18, and that change is the same change referred to in Romans 12:2, which says we'll be transformed by the renewing of our minds. So a sound mind, a renewed mind, where we're now thinking along the same lines that God does, and we think as He does because our mind's been renewed to be agreeable with Him, that's one of the things the Holy Spirit will work in us. So now, I haven't told you what you probably most need to know is that how do you walk in the Spirit? And I can't give you a short answer. The time is up here. I wish I could. There are lectures at my website you can download for free on the Spirit-filled life, and I would recommend maybe you listen to those. But the bottom line is that you just focus on Jesus first, that you put Jesus at the center of all your concerns. You take up your cross and follow Him, deny yourself. Don't worry about your own self. Just be concerned to please God and to glorify Jesus. And I believe the Holy Spirit then will do the rest. But there's more, but unfortunately not time to say more. I apologize for that. The week is over for me here in about 40 seconds, and I need to say that the Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. We pay large bills to the radio stations. We have no sponsors, but we do depend on God to provide through listeners. And if you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address and the resources I mentioned at our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. I hope you'll listen again and tune in on Monday to continue this discussion. God bless you.
We remember the lyrics of songs.